I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello.
Podcast Network Asia.
Obviously, mobility was affected, and that's why we're planning a lot of public spaces. But one thing that we're seeing also that you know that township developments need is affordable housing. You know, I mean, if you think about it, most of the major CBDs, in terms of being able to accommodate the retail and service people that are, you know, manning the stores, you know, those people live 2 hours away, 3 hours away. If you're to become a truly, you know, pandemic resilient city, those people live to be able to live near.
And good evening. Welcome to another episode of the RJ Ledesma podcast. I am RJ Ledesma. Welcome again to this podcast. It's a little bit muggy this Tuesday evening, but you know what? We will keep you guys entertained thoroughly tonight with a really great, great story. I am so happy to have my guest here tonight. We share many commonalities. Our love of real estate. We both went to LaSalle Green Hills for our grade school. High school, and we both share the same master's degree. We both graduated from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology with a degree in real estate development. So, you know, we've had many points of convergence, and this will be the first time that I'll have a chance to drill down and really ask him great questions about real estate development, an industry that and a profession that I love very, very much. But before that, allow me to fully introduce my guest here for this evening. Now, before that, in the RJ Ledesma podcast, I interview the country's pioneering business personalities and entrepreneurs and learn more about how they think about business, what are their success secrets, how they've innovated their businesses during this pandemic, and more importantly, what opportunities do they see emerging in the new normal? Now, is there a business personality or entrepreneur that you would like me to interview here on the show? Please let me know. Just drop me a message. I would love to interview them. We are also live right now on Kumu, CBRC TV, Global Pinas TV, and now on Bounce Back Network. Tonight, we have got one of the youngest, if not the youngest, property CEO in the Philippines for one of the largest real estate development companies here in the country. Now, he may be one of the youngest, but he's got over 19 years worth of experience in financial analysis, leasing and brokerage, development, project management, and property management. He is Delphin Angelo, or better known as Buds Wenceslao. He is in DM Wenceslao and Associates, which has become one of the country's largest publicly listed integrated real estate development and construction companies. DM Wenceslao is also the owner and master developer of the mixed-use district Asiana City. I'm sure you guys have dropped by Asiana City over here in Manila, which is envisioned to be the entertainment and lifestyle center of the Philippines. And I'm very curious to find out what Buds is doing for the project, especially now that we are in the new normal. Will it still be the next entertainment and lifestyle center of the Philippines? What have they done to pivot the business and make sure that it continues to survive and thrive here in the new normal? With that, please welcome my good friend, Buds Wenceslao. Buds, welcome. Thanks so much for joining me here on the show.
Thanks, RJ. Thanks for having me, man. It's a great of you to invite me. I know we've been meaning to catch up for such a long time. It's great to finally be able to do this show.
I'm really so happy to have you over here. You know, the great thing about Buds is that we share so many common experiences, although it might not look at it, but we are actually generations apart, me Buds, you know. But then we've got common experiences.
Not that far, RJ.
Not that far. But we've got the same thing, same experience for high school, same experience for our graduate school, right? And you know, the way that we look at real estate is maybe the same in some aspects, but you've got a larger bird's eye perspective of what real estate is like in the Philippines. And many people are very curious right now as to the state of real estate development, especially in light of this pandemic and the new normal. But before we start, Buds, you know, I mean, people here might not be too familiar with DM Wenceslao, but what they might be more familiar with is Asiana City. And, you know, the scope of this project is just totally mind-boggling. Can you tell us a bit more about what Asiana City is all about?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, RJ. You know, obviously, you know, this is our company's or our family's flagship project. You know, the main difference between Asiana City and our flagship projects within other developments that we actually got to see this project from water. You know, being a reclamation company, we were actually the one who reclaimed this this property into land. And it's only now that we're seeing it in the fruition as we go from water to land and now to buildings and to basically building a whole community. So, you know, it's been a pretty long journey for the company. You know, we started in 1965 from just doing roads, you know, being government contractors, to expanding into marine construction and land banking. And now, you know, out of necessity, we've already transformed into doing real estate development, you know, to doing this, not just small buildings, to office buildings, to everything that you would see in a whole community. Obviously, we've just graduated from just doing infrastructure. Now we're doing residential developments, retail developments.
Yes.
We're doing, you know, public spaces like parks. Obviously, we've taken a lot of time to also take a look at transport planning within the area. So it's just a gradual transformation from being just a general contractor, a construction company, to being a fully integrated real estate company.
Wow, that's quite a journey, and I want to be able to dissect each of those pieces together, because there's a whole story from being a water reclamation contractor to becoming a residential and real estate developer, and 30 years. So let's talk about what's happening here right now. Your crown jewel right now of DM Wenceslao is Asiana City, right? And tell us a bit more about Asiana City. I mean, there's so many people. There are so many what we call, township developments. There are so many residential developments. But what is Asiana City, and what makes it stand out from all the other developments here right now in Metro Manila?
I think, you know, I mean, it goes a lot into our heritage being an infrastructure company. And we've seen a lot of developments. Obviously, there's a lot of other townships in the area. But Asiana City is the last remaining largest landmarks in the city that remains undeveloped. So, you know, our company, where we stand from, I mean, anywhere else you look in the world, obviously, you always see that the ones facing, you know, some body of water is always the most prime development.
That's right.
And I think all of the developments that you see right now is obviously mixed use. But one of the major anchors that we see is there's a big entertainment anchor within that area. Obviously, you have the integrated resorts, the casinos. You have retail with obviously the biggest malls there. So we're basically building the anchors to feed these developments. That's why we're focused on mostly office and residential developments. But, you know, that being said, you know, we want to make it a holistic development. That's why even the park system we're putting in, you know, institutional uses like churches, sidewalks and all of these areas to make it a big community. Obviously, we've also attracted schools like North Anglia and Singapore School. So we want to make it into a vibrant community. So we're attracting all of these different anchors.
Well, this is fantastic, because if you think about the incubation period, which was quite some time, about 30 years, the way that you're developing it is it's nice, because you're playing with if we both have a degree in real estate development, this is like city planning from scratch, and it's fantastic, because it's like you're literally playing, I would call it Monopoly, like, you know, you're putting the pieces together, and it's like Lego building a city from scratch the way that you'd like to build it.
Absolutely. You know, over the years, as we develop the city, you know, we see things that we need to be able to complete the execution of our projects. And, you know, over time, from just doing roads, then all of a sudden we started needing architects. And now we have interior designers. We even have horticulturists within our own teams. Everything that we need to complete the execution of the master plan of Asiana, it's something we've already put inside the company.
Well, and tell us a bit more about, I've seen Asiana, and, you know, what I see over there is the largest Ayala malls in the Philippines. No? But aside from that one, there's a lot of great projects that you're doing inside Asiana. Among all these different projects, what do you find to be sort of like if it's a crown, which are the jewels in the crown in Oceana right now that you are particularly proud of? I'm sure the Manila Bay, Ayala Manila Bay project is one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously we're building a lot of recurring income projects, mostly office. But I would have to say the most important or the crown jewel that we're on task right now is Sparkal. I think I've told you about this project before. You know, it's our first public space/retail/commercial project. You know, in this age of COVID, I mean, I think everybody realizes as a need to be able to find some semblance of outdoor public space, especially in high density townships. And then, you know, it's also very timely. Like when we developed this project, it's basically, we never knew that obviously that COVID was going to happen. But, you know, this Parkal project, if you see it, it's basically a mix of a park, a street, and commercial buildings. And what you have is that you have these 9 individual buildings with a park in between them, and that's covered by a canopy. So, you know, thinking of people looking for outdoor space, you know, it'll be able to accomplish that. At the same time, it'll be interconnected. All of these 9 buildings will be interconnected on the second floor. It'll be interconnected to the higher density buildings we're building around it. And we're pretty sure it's going to tap a much needed space that everybody's looking for right now.
Wow. So this is that's, for me, is pretty mind blowing. That's a great project, which is going to take several years actually to finish. And when I look at it,
actually, RJ, it's finishing next year.
Wow, next year, fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, hopefully, I hope to bring the Mercato Central over there as well to Parkal.
Absolutely, you know, there's 4 plazas there, and we're obviously looking for a lot of a smaller locator, especially from the food industry, to be able to cater to that market.
Excited about the project. And having said that, no, but. Just to clarify the difference, no? There's DM Wenceslao and there's Oceana. So DM Wenceslao is still a contractor. Basically, it's a general contractor, and DM Wenceslao, and then Oceana is sort of like a real estate developer. How does that work? What's the relationship between both?
So DM Wenceslao is basically the mother company, right? So it basically has several development arms under it, namely one for... Office, one for residential, you know, one of our other uses are obviously for our real estate services on the property management side also. So all of these services are what completes the entire DM Wenceslao.
Wow. Right now, no, I'm looking at it. It's a reclaimed area. Give us a good feel of just how large that reclaimed area is. Well, when you were given that area, what exactly comprises not just Oceana but the reclaimed area of DM Wenceslao there in Manila?
So the entire 204 hectares that we reclaim, that encompasses some of the areas of Pagcor Entertainment City, including Solaire, City of Dreams, and portions of even Resorts World. What's left with the company is mostly the private areas that see right now. The Ayala Malls, Bay Area, the DFA Passport Plaza is there, the schools that you see, Singapore School, North Anglia, SNR. So those are the areas that are still in private hands. So when you reclaim, basically a portion of it will go to the government. So that share that went to the government became the entertainment city and all the public roads. Yeah.
And then, how much of the area right now that's privately held by DM Wenceslao has been developed, and how much more is there to develop in the area?
So there's still a lot left in the land bank. So we still have from the total DM Wenceslao has, it's about 57 hectares. Roughly a half of that is still undeveloped. So we're looking to develop that over the year term. You know, we have a 5-year pipeline of developing, selling, and leasing. And right now we're on track to build roughly 300,000 square meters within the next 4 years, and roughly about five hectares left for leasing and selling. The rest is still for future plans.
Well, so I guess you won't be sleeping for the next couple of years, Bud. It sounds like it.
Absolutely. I think this project will be a lifetime project. And to be quite frank, I think it's going to encompass even our generation, RJ.
That's right. Now, having said that, no, the interesting thing about this project, like you said, Parkal has been in pipeline, and by next year, it's going to come online already. It's going to be up. But at the same time, no, one of the things I'm most interested with is that, you know, when the pandemic hit, this area was supposed to be the entertainment and lifestyle center. You were trying to create a new nucleus for that area here, no? How exactly did the pandemic affect you? I guess in terms of leasing out office space, residential space, and more importantly, also making it that nucleus for the lifestyle and entertainment center. Did this pandemic change your plans in any way?
Obviously, you know, we had several locators across different industries, you know, from logistics companies to digital companies. We had a lot of retail developments, you know, we had event centers, schools, everything, you name it, you know, we had it. So all of these industries were hit in some way. But again, you know, since we're building a complete township, I think it's one of the major advantages of building a total mixed-use community. So at least for most of our locators, we had different uses, you know, from groceries to essential services and essential, you know, essential products. So we were able to basically pivot right away. And most of our business locators were able to, especially even our residential locators, had all of the essential needs that were in the community itself. You know, not that, that being said, you know, not just within our own development, but just within the neighboring communities, obviously. In the Bay Area, you have all these large malls, and those have been able to serve the residents of ASEANA.
Wow. So it wasn't a difficult pivot because basically the sort of ecosystem that was needed was already in place for the longer
term. Yeah. And you know, I think we make it a point also to have retail available on all the ground floor spaces of our building. So all of those ground floor locators were able to service most of the business and residential residents of ASEANA City.
But how about in terms of the lifestyle and entertainment portion? Let's say we know that there was a lot of gaming. I don't know if any of the gaming is under the private the private land that's in the area there right now. But there's a lot of entertainment that was going on. Was that affected in any way by the pandemic? Because obviously we were banking on a lot of international tourism coming to the area and that stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's to be candid about it. I mean, without the international visitors coming, you know, there's gaming and hospitality sector in that area has been hit. You know, I don't know if people know, but you know, actually 60% of all future hotel supply is actually coming up in that area, not just the ones beside the casinos, but even the three-star, two-star hotels are also within that area. But the good thing is, you know, those hotels have been able to serve the quarantine requirements of the country, and a lot of them have been able to pivot to that.
Wow.
Hello there, Chinky Tan here, motivational speaker, wealth coach, best-selling author, and now host of Chink Positive Podcast, a podcast that aims to help you to become wealthy and debt-free by teaching you on how to save, budget, get out of debt, and invest. Powered by Podcast Network Asia. Available on wherever you get your podcasts. See you there!
So really great story right now. It seems to be that you're on the way over there, budget. You've got a bright future ahead for DM Wenceslao. But there was a time, no? I mean, and we've had this conversation in the past when things weren't that easy. Like we said, no, going back to the when you summarized the whole history of the company of DM Wenceslao when you started off, you were reclaiming land from water. And it took about 30 years. It was your grandfather's time and it didn't seem to be, you know, it wasn't picking up until recently. Let's step back a bit more, no? Can you tell us a bit more about the genesis? I mean, when it started off, give us a bit of a history lesson. When was this property being reclaimed? I guess this was the Marcos era, right? When this property was still being looked at and you know, for possibility of reclamation.
Actually, you know, so we started claiming during Cory Aquino time. This was This was in the late 80s when we got the contract to the start of the 90s. So yeah, I mean, when we got there was basically a hole there that we needed to fill up. So, you know, being an infrastructure entrepreneur, you know, our chairman, my dad just wanted to fill up the hole, sell the land and move on to another project, you know, as a construction company. That was his mantra. We weren't real estate developers. So when we filled
you were really contractors, general contractors doing during that time. What were the other projects that he was doing? Let's give me an idea. What are the projects like that they were doing at that time? And then he took on this project.
You know, it's mostly horizontal. I mean, we were doing like the Alabang Zapote Road, you know, mostly, horizontal highways and these types of projects. We were doing some housing, but mostly government projects on like highways and infrastructure projects. Like, some dredging here,
some pile driving. We do a lot, until now, actually, we still do a lot of pile driving, but he was never planning to develop. He was just planning to fill up the hole and basically sell the portion that he was going to get and then move on to the next construction project. But, you know, it was this, when we finished, this was, 1997. It was the Asian financial crisis. So everybody that we tried to offer the land to, you know, in some way were either not interested or because it was not the right time. So it was only in the early 2000 when he just said, you know what, I think we should just start doing this ourselves. And that's when we started finding locators to lease the bin. And the first one was actually SNR. The SNR in Asiana there was I think the first major locator in that area. So that's been there since early 2000s.
Wow. And I, you know, that was quite a incubation period, because if you think about it, that you were given the project in the 1980, I guess during the Aquino administration, the first one was about 1987 to 1889, finished in 10 years. I mean, that's really cash flow. That's really cash flow out at that time, no? And how did the company survive at the time? Did you have also multiple projects that helped subsidize the development of this reclaimed area?
Through sheer luck, I think that's the answer to that. You know, I'm never too shy to admit that things, you know, during that time, I think the saying is kawit patalem, right? Oh. So we would sell a small property here. We would lease several a property there to maybe a gas station. But, you know, all in this time, just trying to keep afloat, right? It was only in the mid 2000s when we started seeing much activity, you know, as a lot of the locators started coming in, you know, from the gas stations to the one-story, two-story restaurants. Then all of a sudden, you know, things started picking up. People started buying, you know, some developers started buying land and putting up condos. And then, you know, after we saw most of the development in the major CBDs get filled up, then that's when you see when we saw prices started going substantially up. You know, from 2006 to now, prices have been increasing, you know, roughly at about 20% year on year, compounded annually. So, and that's when we saw that, you know, over time, the real estate portion of the business was now starting to encompass the construction part. In 2013, construction was still 80% of our top line. By 2015, construction was already less than 10% of our top line. That's how fast real estate overtook up that portion of the business.
It was like, could you wait? In other words, like, may PC ba kayo? Mababa yung PC ninyo hanggang umabot sa inyo yung pace ng development from moving outwards from Makati. Is that right? That's how I see it, no?
There was a time, I remember, you know, our chairman would say, no, let's not sell. Let's wait for the price to go up to 100,000 per square. At the time, the price was like 50,000. Parang that's not going to happen in the next 20 years. We would argue with our chairman, with our dad. No, that's never going to happen. That's going to happen maybe when we're all old. But within 3 years' time, the price went up to 120,000 per square. Parang we were surprised at how fast it went up.
Wow. But where came the point for you, no? That when we were looking at the property, this is the very interesting story that you said that you moved from being a water or you know, I could call it a land developer or a reclaimed land developer, and you finally made that leap to say, okay, let's try development. When did that point come for you guys in that conversation or in looking at the company?
I think, you know, when we built our first office building, aptly named Asiana One, it was, you know, we were, I think, probably the second or third office building there. And we were pretty conservative. You know, we didn't put too much glass because we were worried that, you know, we weren't able to make up the returns for it. But, you know, within 1 year's time, that building was fully leased out. Then we built our second office building, you know, okay, let's put in more glass. Let's put some more marble in the lobbies because you know it seems like there's a demand for it. And, you know, before that building got finished, it was fully leased out. Then the third office building, okay, let's make it all glass, right? Let's make it even nicer. Then there, while we were still finishing, somebody got 70% of the space, and you know, and the rest they say is history. You know, we went into residential, and within a year's time, we had fully sold out the residential. Then that's what we decided, you know. It seems like we're selling our long-term potential by selling land to fund our short-term growth when we're doing the buildings. So that's when we decided, you know, I think it's, we have enough track record to go public so that we don't need to sell that much land anymore. And that was a strategy in 2017. That's why we went public. We were able to raise enough cash flow. And that's why even now, even during the pandemic, we're still aggressively building our development pipeline without needing to sell our land back or
sell the land. Wow.
Or increase our debt coverage or our leverage levels to precarious levels. So even now we're still at a very conservative. We still have a very conservative balance sheet, and you know, moving forward, I think we're good for the next 5 years. Yeah.
This is very interesting. So actually, if you go visit Ashana right now, you can see the progression of the how prosperous the company got, or how the economic fortunes improved by the quality of the buildings. The more glass, nag-improve talaga yung economic fortunes of Ashana. Is that right?
You know, I mean, it's just at the same time. You know, I mean, we wanted to obviously we wanted to compete with the other CBDs, and we wanted to make the buildings world class. You know, I mean, RJ, we having had exposure to other international developments, I mean, we see best practices, and we see how to increase the values. I mean, if I had just one property, maybe I just try to make it most cost effective to get the increased returns. But obviously, since we have a larger land bank, we want to make sure that over time the project we build are add more value to the remaining land bank that we have.
When was that inflection point, Buds? Let's say when you were doing it. I mean, you know, I often talk to many entrepreneurs, and this is like a family business. It was very entrepreneurial at that point because you were trying to sell land, I guess, no? And when did that point come to you when you said, oh, things are working. I mean, what we're doing is actually working. Parang yung the point that I can't believe it. It's you know, it's coming true. The land is achieving its value. Where was that point when you stopped and said, this is going to work?
I think, you know, every year we have a planned lot sale. And you know, over the years, we'd say, okay, well, we'll offer this property for sale, you know, this much area. Then over the years, every time, you know, at the beginning of the year, I'd ask our leasing or our marketing, like, how many people are in line to buy the land? And it became from one person to like five companies to 10 companies, then 20 companies, like, and we're only selling, you know, one parcel. And it was pretty fast. Like, if you don't accept this offer, we're going to pass to the next one. Then they'll say, no, we'll make a reservation right now. That's when we saw the, you know, the demand. And I think at the end of the day, you know, the three rules of leasing: location, location, location. And I mean, it's something that you can't take away from Asiana. I mean, it's just a prime location for development. I mean, considering, you know, the major infrastructures within the area, obviously the existing developments, I think it's just a very prime landmark, and you want to be sure that we're able to extract the most value and alpha from that property. And the way we extract value is not through selling or leasing that; it's through development, and that's what we're doing now.
I recall, so it started to pick up in about 2004. Am I right? 2004. That's when things started picking up already for the in terms of sales from land to becoming a, I guess, development already.
That's when the inquiry started coming. You know, started from the gas stations to again SNR to the 1-2-story restaurants. Then it just picked up from there. You know, some developers would buy to build condos. Then, you know, slowly and surely, you know, just development started to pick up, and you would see, and just by the number of tower cranes that you would see in the area, not just in Asiana but within the Manila Bay area, you would see that there's increased development. Yeah. And then obviously when the casinos started coming, then more people, obviously a lot of international people also started coming. Then that's when we saw increased demand, not just in land, but also in condos, in offices, in the ground floor restaurant and retail spaces.
And having said that, no, okay, if this is a family business, right? So, and you guys all seem to be involved. Was it something, and I'm talking because right now, I want to wear another hat, like somebody else doing in, you know, real estate. My family was in the real estate business. Was it something that you were sort of mandated to do when you went to college, took up management economics? You said, okay, you have to support the family business. You all have to work over here. Was that sort of something that was ingrained in you growing up?
Not really. You know, I mean, I don't know how it is with that, but you know, obviously my dad wanted us to work with him. You know, when I graduated, it was just per chance. I graduated in 2000. That was the time that Ashana got finished reclaiming, and there was, you know, there was nobody to man the real estate development department. But you know, that being said, I didn't work for the family when I first graduated. I worked outside. We were all required to work outside before joining the family business. And you know, that's what happened. I was probably employee number two next to the guy who knew all the titles, who was the one paid. I was probably employee number two. Then, you know, it slowly grew from there. You know, I started hiring to people to lease, then started hiring architects, then urban planners, then now we have interior designers, engineers, so project managers, then it just grew from there.
Okay. That's interesting. So literally almost out of college, you joined the family business, but of course you did your 2-year mandatory stint outside before coming in. Is that right? Were you also doing real estate sales before joining the family business?
Yeah. So I was with a company called CB Richard Ellis. So it was a real estate, international real estate services provider. So I learned a lot about leasing and selling property in that company. And, you know, I was able to take that with me, you know, going to our family business.
And that was intentional for you to work for CB Richard Ellis in preparation to work for the family business?
No, not really. It wasn't necessary to work for me for that particular company. We were all required to work outside before joining the family. And you know, even for us, I don't think I would recommend to people who have family businesses to immediately join. I think it's important to get exposure, to not come in as an owner, to be able to learn what it's like to work for other people before working for your own.
Hi, I'm Misha, and I'm inviting you to listen to IMAP Digipod, the Internet and Mobile Marketing Association of the Philippines' first ever podcast. Listen in on our topics and conversations in the advertising and marketing industries and learn from the best from all over the world. This podcast is brought to you by Podcast Network Asia and powered by Podmetrics.
And I like that because that's a sort of mentality that you need to have, I guess, if you work for family business. Like for myself, I worked for Procter & Gamble in brand before actually and did my master's before I actually joined the family business. Now, what you did was you actually worked in a company where the value added that you could bring to DM Wenceslao was very good. You had real estate background before. You had good real estate training before advisory services before entering into the family business.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's just one of the skills that we needed to be able to grow the business. Obviously, you know, if you're looking at the whole real estate development process, obviously you start from planning to construction to project management, then to leasing, selling, property management. Slowly, as the years went by, we started adding these competencies to the company by adding people. That from one person, it became a department, and now we have not just managing the buildings, but also managing the estate also. So we slowly added these things to the company so that we were able to take on, you know, much bigger projects. And even right now, you know, we're looking at other townships also aside from ASEANA, and it'll be easy for us to be able to just transfer the knowledge that we have.
Exactly.
Planning, building, operating, and managing township to another location.
And having said that, no, the company was growing 2000, 2004. You were there to see the growth and you started hiring people. But then amidst all that one, you decided to do a master's in real estate development. I mean, that for me is like, parang it's like that was saying, wait, we got to work on this. And all of a sudden you left. Was it with his blessing? Of course it was with his blessing, but was it reluctant or was it something that you really wanted to do to sort of like take a break or gain more knowledge? What was it like for you during that time?
Nothing. I mean, I don't know, RG. I mean, maybe I'll ask you also, but you know, I realized that finance was one of my, you know, was one of my biggest weaknesses. Explaining to banks how and why a project would, you know, would be able to recoup its investment, to be able to get to explain to banks how to get loans and to create a financial model, to create a financial plan and projections. So this is something which, to be quite frank, I didn't know. Nobody in the company also will teach me how to do it. So it was something that I realized that I don't know. So after doing some research, obviously, you know, I don't know how you know, but obviously I saw that the MIT was one of the best in terms of providing that gap in terms of my capability. That's why I decided to apply. Wow. If you don't mind me asking, RJ, what was your process when you did your master's? Because you know, you also have a family business. People don't know because people know you as this of everything from Mercado to wedding. But what was your thought process when you decided to go?
No, well, actually, I often tell the story that when I applied, I actually wanted to apply for Harvard Business School. And the year before that one, so I applied, you know, I worked. For many people, I guess, but you can relate to this one. No? My ultimate dream was that, you know, I would finish my, you know, after finishing college, 2.5 years worth of working for a multinational and get into hopefully Harvard or any of the top Ivy League schools. And then what happened was that I went to a multinational, I did my GMAS, I thought I got a fairly good score. I applied for Wharton, for Kellogg, and for Harvard. And when I applied for each one of them, you know, at that time, hindi pa uso masyadong email. So it's like a physical submission yan. You had to submit by, you know, the documents. And then, but the first time I got my letter, it was the first one that came from Wharton, and it was a thin letter. And when I opened it up, it said, "Mr. Ledesma, we regret to inform you that you didn't get in." I was going, "Oh my God!" You know, I was surprised. You know, I thought, you know, I had a good academic background and work background. And then the second one is I got a letter again from Northwestern, and it's Kellogg, which is known for marketing, and I was doing brand, so I thought, okay, this would be a shoo-in. But again, the letter said, "We regret to inform you, but we did not accept you." And then finally, I got the third letter from Harvard, which was like my dream school. And again, the letter was thin. And I didn't know what was going to happen. So I very carefully opened up the letter, and it said, "Mr. Ledesma, you're one of the 10% that we are considering for this batch. You can either do a phone interview or a live interview in Harvard for about 5 minutes, right?" And me being a public speaker and everything else, I said, "Let me try to impress them and fly over there for that five minute interview." I told them I flew over there, and I thought I gave a really good talk. But then 2 weeks later, I received a letter saying, "I'm sorry, you weren't accepted." So pretty, you know. So, but after the time, it gave me time to step back. And, you know, I first resigned from my job and helped out the family business, because this was amidst the Asian economic crisis when this was happening. And I went back to research, and I found out that there were actually real estate development degrees. And I was surprised, because I was saying, this is just so apt for the family to do this one. So there was Columbia and there was MIT, and I applied for both, and I got in. And I guess the rest is history. You know, it was very, very good, because I mean, got many good friends who've done the programs. Like we've got the head of Cebu Land Masters, actually, Franco. Franco Soberano did Columbia. Rufino did Raymond Rufino did, of course, he also did Columbia, and myself and you and Cholo Kailao, we all did MIT. And it's been a really great experience of what we learned over there and brought it back over here. Especially, you know, I learned about REITs, real estate investment trusts, almost 20 years ago, because I graduated in 2001. And can you imagine, we're just doing REITs right now?
my thesis for our program was on REITs. And this was when they passed in 2008. And it's only now that we're doing it.
Yeah. I wrote about this. I mean, if you're a real estate nerd or a geek, mine was on establishing a secondary mortgage market in the Philippines. So I guess medyo magkalapit yung ating ginaga. Maybe if you had my paper, you could have just taken my paper, taken some of the research material, and then used it as well for what you were doing there. So very interesting story how you started off with that degree and how it, you know, for you, it launched your real estate career. For me, it launched many different things when I came back over here. But going back to you, Buds, when you were there in the States, did there come a point for you, and I hope you don't mind me asking, that you were saying, "Hey, this is a break for me. I can actually," because you're given you can actually work in the States for a year after get your graduate degree there, right? I mean, that your visa allows you to do that one. Did you have that notion where you said, "Maybe I should stay here a bit longer and learn a bit more? Maybe it's a bit of an escape for me first before coming back home, or maybe even staying there for a couple of years?"
Well, actually, you know what? I mean, I graduated in 2008, so this was the global, the mortgage financial meltdown. So it wasn't a good time to consider going there. But, you know, at the same time, you know, having had classmates there, I don't know if you've had this epiphany, but, you know, some of the things, obviously, the only thing I could probably do there was probably finance, you know, because it's very universal. Development, you know, it's more, I think it would be more in tune, especially for Boston, for locals.
Like, exactly.
We need to know people in the Boston Redevelopment Authority, and, you know, we didn't know anybody from there. But, you know, one of the things I learned was that after having had so many classmates, that I'm okay in finance, but it wasn't my strong point. For me to be able to do development, I really need to come home. And, you know, after spending about a year and a half there, I think it was just time. I felt that it was time for me to come home also.
And that says something, I guess, about, and correct me if I'm wrong, I get this feeling that really when you do development, in particular real estate development, it's not just the skill sets, right? It's in each country particularly, it's a little bit different because the permitting process is different, the construction process is different. I mean, the States, it's all technology, right? It's all about technology over here. We're labor intensive in our construction, right? I mean, many different things.
I think, in terms of real estate, development is very local.
Agreed.
In the sense that a Boston developer, if he goes to New York, would probably not do as well. Or, real estate development is local, but, maybe finance, you can do international, if you're doing acquisitions or you're doing asset management. But yeah, I mean, if you literally just want to go and build stuff, I think you need to be in a place where you know a lot of people, you know the practices, you have a lot of connections. So I think that's something which I found to be more attuned towards what I wanted to do. And considering what we're already doing, I just felt that it was time to go home. And every time I see, when I got back within 1 year, I had already broken, we had already broken ground on our first office building. I mean, if I had stayed, I don't know how long the permitting process would have taken, in other countries, sometimes the permitting process takes years to get done. Yeah.
Wow. Well, it sometimes takes years here as well in the Philippines, unless, like you said, no, it's real estate sometimes in the Philippines and development is really whom you know and how well you're able to work your connections over here. I mean, that's just the reality of the game, I guess, no? Would you agree with that, Buds?
Yeah, I think it goes for all countries. I mean, it's just for development, I think it's just easier. Or it's easier to do it when you have all of your networks in place.
Yeah, and like they say, when you say real estate developer, it's not just one thing. It's sort of like there's a big book on real estate development, but if you look at the role of a real estate developer, I've had Cesar Rui on this show. I've had people like Pete Felix of Finma and Jerry Choa, one of my idols from Pro Friends. I mean, real estate developer is not just construction. You have to have so many different skill sets just to do what you're doing, diba?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure, as an entrepreneur yourself, RJ, you're wearing so many hats. I'm pretty sure in all of these businesses that you have, you're sometimes a lawyer, you're sometimes an accountant, you're sometimes a broker, you're sometimes an HR manager, you're sometimes a friend. All of these hats that you have to wear for all of these businesses. So even right now, in our company, it's one of the thrills of being an entrepreneur that you get to do so many things, so many varied things.
Yeah, it really stretches you. I mean, it stretches you as an entrepreneur and it stretches you as a business person because there's different challenges every day working in real estate. I guess that's, and please.
Yeah, if you don't mind me asking, like how do you do it? Like I see, you're doing so many different things. I mean, how do you get to manage all of these? Sometimes, when I'm feeling lazy, then one of your feeds come up and like, oh my God, RJ is like the busiest man in Facebook. I have to get off my butt and start working because whenever I see all the things you do, I feel like, oh my God, I'm so lazy. But RJ is doing so many things. So.
No, I guess when I look at people like you, but it's really that, different, I call it ways to success, W-A-Z-E to success. I mean, there are many different routes to get to where you want to be, where you consider your own definition of successful. And I often look at people like Injap Sia. Why? Because if you look at Injap's model, right, for success, remember, Injap started off selling out of the back of his car in Iloilo, his chicken in a sal, right? I think he's actually, I can be corrected if I'm wrong, but a college dropout because he wanted to sell. He was such entrepreneurial, right? And he built that business big enough to irritate Jollibee that they bought him out. And basically, he used that money that he generated from there to put up Double Dragon, right? And then from there, Double Dragon, he put up Mary Mart. And I'm just thinking that, there are many ways to do in real estate. And for me, it was, staying in the family business. Mine was to say, maybe I have to step out of the family business, gain a lot of experience, build the network because your network is your net worth. And hopefully, with everything that you've gained, you're able to bring in something to the business that wasn't there before. Because in real estate, it's highly competitive. If you don't have the capital to do it, what more can you offer that others cannot? And sometimes innovation comes from seeing what other people are doing in other industries and bring it into your own. I mean, if you look at how Injap did Double Dragon, he was taking knowledge that he gained from the franchising industry and brought that into doing into Double Dragon, you know? And the way he's been flipping properties is exactly, you know, if you're doing franchising, it makes perfect sense, right? But if you came from a purely real estate background, things didn't make too much sense. It wasn't something that you'd look at. So that's why for me, I do all these different things because I'm trying to gain experience outside. And hopefully the ultimate goal is to go back to real estate development. I love this bus because it's the first time I'm actually getting interviewed by my subject. And this is really good. So I lie. Thanks for asking me as well. And I'm glad to share this story over here. Now, having said that, you know, I mean, this is the other interesting thing. So when you came back, the value of an MBA or a master's degree nowadays, because of the startup world, because of everything, I don't know how valuable it was, as you know, like maybe is an MBA as valuable as it was before, given the startup world, given all the, you know, it's easier now to learn things online. What is the value of that your master's degree? Did it really help you a lot when you came back over here and talking to banks? Did you learn? Because sometimes I found that, you know, it's so advanced sometimes that when you bring it back here, especially for the finance portion, it wasn't quite something that could be applied. But what was of use? Was it also the connections that you made that helped you out a lot when you finished the degree?
I think if there's one thing I learned, you know, that I'm taking with me and helping me do whatever it is I'm doing right now, you know, it's the value of making data-driven decisions. I don't know if you also see this, RJ. I mean, one of the things I learned is that you can compete for anything. You can compete for probabilities on sensitivities on what happens when, let's say, lease rates go down, when your construction cost goes up. So all of these things, you know, I take with me. And I think it was from a Michael Bloomberg book, right? That said that for everything, have faith in God. For all else, you should trust in data, right? So it's something to that effect. So it's something even with my manager, I say, you know, okay, you're recommending this, but where's the data that supports it? It's something I always still enforce or still implement with all of my major business decisions to make sure that the decision I'm making, especially financial decisions, is something that's backed up by data. And that's something that I wouldn't have learned if I didn't see how MIT would teach you. Obviously, some of it is, you know, using basically a bazooka for a kill a fly, right? But in essence, you know, having been trained to do all of these analysis, at least helps you get to the small decisions. And to the big decisions, you know, having that there, you know that you can always get back to it. Is that something that you've taken with you, RJ? I mean,
right now, I work a lot in the startup world. And many of them are so, I mean, unlike before, they're so data-driven right now because there's so much more data available now than before. And you know how data analytics actually plays a larger part in what we're doing right now than before. I mean, I can see how it's really key in the real estate industry and how it's really forming decisions and that data is going to be king in the next couple of years. I mean, pretty soon, Buds, I'm sure that you in Ashana will have to have a data scientist right now to sift through the data eventually that you're going to be needing to make decisions about the area. And that's good. And I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. You know, even right now, so we've plugged in, you know, sensors to analyze traffic in the area through the CCTVs. But, you know, we're still, you know, big data is still very, still a nascent technology and we're still studying on how to harness that data.
Wow. And now I want to talk about something a bit different right now. And I find this very interesting. And we've had this conversation is that you're 41 years old and all your brothers are older than you, but you're the CEO of the company and your dad is like the chairman. So basically they've given you the seat to help manage the company. And for other people, they would find that, you know, why give it to the youngest to run the business? I hope you don't mind me asking, you know, because this might be a very sensitive issue, but why give it to the youngest person to run the company? Does it also cause some friction, I guess, amongst the siblings and even with your dad? I mean, I'm very proud of what you're doing, of course. No, but then, I mean, tell me a bit more about that one. I mean, that must have been a very, very equitable process of deciding, okay, but you run the company.
So, just so we're, you know, right here, obviously, as the CEO, I'm the more or less the mouthpiece. You know, I'm the one who does the interviews. I'm the one who fronts the analyst to explain to banks. But looking at it from a business standpoint, that's because real estate, which I handle, is already 90% of the business right now. It just makes it easier to explain to our partners, our bankers, and everybody what the business is about. But that being said, you know, it's still largely run by a committee. You know, all the governance things that we put in when we went public,
you know, I have a fully functional board. We have independent directors who provide input. So all of the major decisions are still coursed through our executive committee and our board. It's just that I'm the one implementing everything. But, you know, me and my brothers, the way we see ourselves is obviously we are part owners. We are owners of the business, but we're mostly stewards of the business. And what I mean by stewards is that we realize that this is a business that we will pass on to the next generation. So we are making sure that we're putting in the work that the company is financially and structurally better than when we took it over. So even right now, we're trying to make sure that we increase the professionals in the company, the professional managers, just because we know that by the time that we're all of retirement age, you know, the next youngest Wenceslao is still going to be pretty young, like in his 20s. So we need to ensure that the line of professional managers who will manage the business is there. And that's something that we're preparing, even though it's going to happen 20 years from now, even right now, we're already preparing for that.
Wow. So given that one, how exactly does is it like a sort of like a management by committee? You and your siblings discuss, okay, the decisions, or is it something that your dad still comes in and says, okay, I want it this way? I mean, help me run through. This is very interesting for me. I hope you don't mind me asking.
So day to day operationally, it's already our generation was running along with obviously with our professional managers. We prefer to obviously hire professional managers who are, you know, who are experts. I mean, our CFO is a CPA lawyer, so we are making sure that the best people run the respective department regardless of their last name. And moving forward, we foresee that more and more people who aren't Wenceslaos will be running, you know, specific business lines. That's what we foresee in the future. And, you know, I mean, we have different people running, you know, different companies, but obviously the major decisions on how much we're building, how much we're selling, you know, that's basically decided on a committee basis. And it's still run mostly by the entire family, with input from our professional managers. But there's not, you know, moving forward, there's never going to be, you know, there's never going to be one person that says, I'm the boss, everyone follows me. No, it's not like that. It's more or less run on a committee basis.
Yeah. You know, before everything else, I just want to say this, Buzz, that I'm very inspired by you and very motivated by you. You know, to me, you know, I've always looked forward to becoming a real estate developer where I'm running the show. But, you know, I think it's going to take a bit more time until I get there in terms of maturity and capital. But then, when I look at you, I'm impressed by people like you, like Cesar, like Raymond, Cesar Weifuicom, like Raymond Rufino, like Carrie Lagdameo of the Mosalan. So many of you, you know, making big decisions, really helping, you know, power, you know, helping power the economy, being a great multiplier. I know that recently you also had a great deal also as well with Carrie Lagdameo, who I hope to have on the show very soon. What was that deal that you guys had with Carrie that was very good in Makati?
So we just purchased an existing asset of theirs that they wanted to unload. It was something that I think they wanted to unload for some time. And, you know, as luck would have it, you know, I mean, I was friends with Gary and I called him up and I asked, you know, if the opportunity was still open, we would like to make an offer. And if you're dealing with straightforward people, you know, I think Gary and I closed that deal within like two or three meetings just because we both trusted each other that we would get the deal done fast and pretty easily. And, you know, if I could do more deals like that, especially with people like Gary, like the Mayo, I mean, it would be a great opportunity.
Fantastic. And so this is one project where actually it was not anymore technically within what you guys used to do. I mean, before it used to be first land developer, reclaimed land developer, now residential developer, office developer. Now you just technically just bought something outside of Ashana. How does that all fit into the strategy of what you guys have been doing with DMSS now and Ashana?
Yeah, so, you know, like what I said, RG, parang the skill set and execution set that we have, it's pretty easy to already transfer that in other locations. So even that property that we bought, we are planning to obviously in the future tear it down and build something more dense.
I see.
We're actually doing another project also in Makati, Jupiter Street. So again, if we see good properties that are available, it's so easy for us within at least within the, you know, within Metro Manila to be able to do that already. And it's something that we're continuing to do as long as we find the opportunities to invest and diversify in other locations.
Fantastic. And having said all that, Buds, you know, I mean, I wish we had more time in the world. I would go on for 2 hours talking to you right now on the podcast. Is that, you know, to have a unique perspective where you were able to see many business opportunities in real estate, whether it be sales or development, or also affiliate industries, you know, industries that intersect with real estate or that emerge from real estate. I often ask people here in the show, what are the opportunities that you're seeing emerge in the next normal or for the real estate industry that you, if you weren't doing what you're doing right now, you would pursue it? What are these opportunities you're seeing that are emerging that are very exciting for you that, you know, if you had the time or if you could make two buds, you would be getting into those businesses?
Well, we're actually in the planning stages of it just right now. But I think, you know, we mentioned because of what's happening with the pandemic. So obviously mobility was affected. And that's why we're planning a lot of public spaces. But one thing that we're seeing also that, you know, that township developments need is affordable housing. You know, I mean, if you think about it, most of the major CBDs, in terms of being able to accommodate the retail and service people that are, you know, manning the stores, you know, those people live 2 hours away, 3 hours away. Mm-hmm. If you're to become a truly, you know, pandemic resilient city, those people live to be able to live near. So actually right now we're planning product to be able to accommodate the workers who man the shops, who man the restaurants, who man the services of Asiana. And it's also going to be within Asiana, since we have a lot of interim land use, a lot of land that's available. We're planning to do it on an interim basis.
So sort of like a socialized condominium. You do socialized housing, you do a socialized condominium. Wow, that's a really, and that's a big picture, because people don't realize that in the Philippines right now, there's a 7.5 million housing backlog, and it never works when you relocate people from specific areas away from their places of work. That's where you get squat. That's when you develop informal settlers. If you relocate people to locations where there's no jobs, that's when the housing strategy doesn't work. So what you're doing right now is very on strat, making sure that not only develop the city, but you make sure that the ecosystem of the city works very well.
Yeah. You know, I mean, when we were, you know, just came from several like requests from some of our office leaders that since they were all here in the office and they didn't want their people coming home and being exposed, they asked to use the offices to sleep also, to use some of their available space for, you know, for people to sleep. And you know, most office buildings don't allow. But during the pandemic, we allow just to be able to accommodate. But again, we see this need that's not being met right now in some of the cities, just because, you know, the prices are so expensive. It needs to be able to have a product specific to that particular requirement.
And it's exactly, I mean, that's just thinking like an entrepreneur, right? First, it seems like it's an irritation, but it's actually a pain point. You go, oh, you know, yeah, they got to sleep here. But then if you think like an entrepreneur, you go, hey, they have to sleep here. Let me wear my entrepreneurial lens. Hey, that's a great idea. Let's put something up for them, because there's a underserved segment. There's a demand for it. And if your employees could use it, other people's employees could use it just as well, right?
Yeah, you know, we actually saw some models of it in manufacturing hubs, right? Obviously for factory workers. So why not for service workers in the city, you know, like obviously for waiters, for janitors and all of those people. So yeah, I think there's definitely going to be a demand finding the right product. It's something that we're still doing R&D on.
Wow. Really great idea, Buds. And then I guess the last thing I want to end with is, you know, what's really next for Asiana City and for DMS Aslao? Because, you know, I know that, you know, there's so much property that you self-develop. Like you said, there's about 57 hectares still worth of property that is ripe for development. Maybe in your lifetime, you won't be able to finish all of that. But what's next? Will you guys also be developing, you know, to my mind, because you're developing a lot of commercial properties, those can be turned into REITs, right? You're doing office space that can be turned into REITs, even your residential. If you do the socialized housing, that can be turned into a socialized housing REIT. Is that something that you guys are also looking into as well?
Absolutely. You know, having done my thesis on REITs, I mean, we have a company actually that's where all the commercial recurring income properties are. That being said, you know, I don't think we're at the right stage right now. We still have roughly 40% of our IPO proceeds that we haven't utilized. So we're still going to use that to build our existing pipeline. But you know, maybe 3 years, 4 years down the line, it's something that we'll definitely explore.
Wow, thanks a lot, Buds. The future looks really bright for you guys, and I'm so glad that you and the rest of the Wenceslao family are at the helm of doing this project. I wish you good health, because you're going to need it for the next couple of years to see this through. And glad to work with you and find ways to collaborate with you to help make the Ashana dream a reality. So again, thank you so much, Buds Wenceslao. Buds Wenceslao, I'm looking forward to interviewing more great property developers as young and as dynamic as you here on the RJ Ledesma podcast. I hope you guys all enjoyed the podcast, and if you've learned a lot from it, please subscribe and invite more friends to listen to the RJ Ledesma podcast. Again, thanks so much, Buds Wenceslao. We will see you guys again next week. Thank you.
Thanks, RJ. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
The views and opinions expressed by the podcast creators, hosts, and guests do not necessarily reflect the official policy and position of Podcast Network Asia. Any content provided by the people on the podcast are of their own opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything.